Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host for this evening, Ethan Elkind. What California foodie wouldn't love to grab a plate of pasta for lunch in North Beach, hop on a high-speed train in downtown San Francisco, and arrive in downtown Los Angeles in time to enjoy Chili Rellenos for dinner off Olvera Street, perhaps even taking the subway to Hollywood for a night on the town, all car-free? Well, if everything goes according to plan, that dream could become a reality by the year 2029, the current projected completion date for the first phase of California's high-speed rail. In 2008, Californians approved a proposition authorizing the issuance of $9.95 billion in bonds to construct a high-speed rail line between Los Angeles and San Francisco, along with related transportation improvements. The measure passed with little organized opposition. But 8 years later, the project has lost some of its luster, and many in our state are questioning whether this huge infrastructure project can or should become a reality. Dubbed by critics as the train to nowhere, the high-speed rail project has continued to run into roadblocks that have driven up the cost and delayed the completion date. Will high-speed rail transform California, improving our environment by taking cars off the road and stimulating our economy by enhancing travel between our cities? Or will we find ourselves burdened by debt for a system that is underutilized and quickly becoming out of date? To tell us about the current state of the project and answer questions and concerns about the benefits it will provide to California, I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Dan Richard, Chair of the Board of Directors of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Dan has been an independent energy consultant since 2010. Prior to that, he was managing partner and co-founder of Heritage Oak Capital Partners, an infrastructure finance firm, and was senior vice president of public policy and governmental relations at Pacific Gas and Electric Company. Dan was an elected member of the San Francisco Bay Area Rapid Transit District from 1992 to 2004, where he served twice as president of the board. At the BART District, he led efforts to secure $4 billion in capital for system rehabilitation projects, the transit system's expansion to the San Francisco Airport, and seismic retrofit programs. Dan also served as Governor Brown's Deputy Legal Affairs Secretary from 1982 to 1983, back in the second term of four for Governor Brown, and Deputy Assistant for Science and Technology from 1978 to 1979. He was also advisor to the chairman of the California Energy Commission from 1978 to 1982, a distinguished history in state politics. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you very much, Ethan.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. Do you think high-speed rail will be a boon or a bust for California? We want to hear your thoughts on this topic, so please reach out. So, Dan, let's start from the beginning here. Let's just the basics for people who are not familiar with high-speed rail. What is high-speed rail? How do you define high-speed rail?
Well, actually, the voters of California accepted the definition that was in the bond measure in 2008, which was that we would construct a system that initially would be 520 miles from San Francisco to Los Angeles, connecting the various regions of the state with fully electric trains that had to be capable of running at a sustained speeds above 200 miles an hour, and that had to be able to was designed to achieve a nonstop time from San Francisco to LA in 2 hours and 40 minutes or less. And interestingly enough, also had to be designed to operate without a financial subsidy, which is something that we've seen with high-speed rail systems around the world. So they're very different from systems like BART or Muni, which do, even if they're very efficient, require subsidies. These high-speed rail systems, once they're built, tend to be self-sustaining, and that's what the voters voted for here.
And you mentioned the ballot initiative in 2008. Can you give us a little bit of the history of the system and how it came to be here in California?
Going back to 1996, then State Senator Quentin Kopp authored a bill to create a high-speed rail authority in California, with the idea that California would benefit from having this type of intercity transportation system. And for about 12 years, they did planning and they did some environmental analysis and they looked at other systems and so forth. 2008 was the pivotal year because two things happened on election night in 2008. First, as you mentioned, the voters passed Proposition 1A, which provided the funding for us to get started here. And the second thing that happened was Barack Obama was elected president, and in his stimulus program, there was actually $8 billion set aside for a nationwide high-speed rail network to start. California ended up getting the lion's share of that, about $3 billion for one state, all told, from the federal government. So that's really what kicked things off in 2008.
So the voters approved it. We have some money from the federal government, from the state bond issue. So can you tell us what's happened since then? What's the current status of the system?
Well, since 2008, a lot of things have happened. And really, the turning point, I think, for this program was Governor Jerry Brown's election in 2010. You know, the program was troubled before then. There was a lot of criticism of both the structure of it, the idea, and the ridership projections and so forth. And Governor Brown had to look at this and decide whether or not it was something that he felt he should get behind or that we should move beyond it. After spending about 8 months with top advisors looking at it, the governor made the decision that this was something he felt was important for California. I was appointed just after that, along with another person that he brought in who was has a deep financial background. And we really tried to reconfigure the program in two very important ways. First, I think our realization was that we shouldn't just be talking about high-speed rail. California has embarked on a widespread rail modernization to vault us into the rest of the 21st century. And high-speed rail is kind of the spine of that, but we're also putting money into BART modernization, into similar systems in Southern California, the electrification of Caltrain, et cetera, et cetera. So we've really started to look at this, and maybe it was my background working at BART, that high-speed rail could not be a separate standalone system, but had to be an integral part of an overall modernized rail transportation system. And the second thing we did was to try to get our house in order in terms of the numbers, the ridership projections, cost and operating costs, capital and operating costs. And I think that we've done a very good job, thanks to my friend Mike Rossi, who was appointed by the governor, who has a deep financial background, in really cleaning up those numbers. We're now in construction. A lot of people here in the Bay Area don't realize this, but America's first high-speed rail system is under construction in the Central Valley, and I can talk a little bit more about that. But we've moved from kind of the planning phase into the reconfiguration of the program and now into the construction phase.
So let's talk about that. So what are the plans? You mentioned there's construction happening now. What are the sort of segments, the sections of the system that's going to be built through the estimated completion date of 2029?
So we started in the Central Valley, and this was actually a decision that was made before I was on the high-speed rail board. But in looking at it and having been skeptical initially, I decided that this actually was the right place to start. And there are several reasons for that. One is that with the available funding that we have now, and I know we'll get into the funding question, we can build more miles of track for each dollar in the Central Valley than we could coming into the cities. So we get ourselves going. We need to test the trains at up to 250 miles an hour, and a little hard to do that between San Francisco and San Jose.
Well, let me ask you about that real quick, because I've heard this before. It's good to test it. But given that this is a tried and true technology, you see high-speed trains in Europe and Japan and China, how come there is this need to have to test it?
Oh, you have to test every system as applied, because you're putting trains and train control signaling communication systems. You have to show that they can all work. When we expanded BART into the East Bay up towards Pittsburgh and out towards Dublin Pleasanton, there were a couple of months where there were some real issues because of the integration of the new track and the older track. So these systems have to be tested to give you confidence that you can operate them safely. And, the other reason for the Central Valley, we don't tend to think about it here. I've lived in Northern California for almost 40 years. And most people in this community don't really think about the Central Valley. But the 4 million people in the Central Valley constitute a population that's bigger than half the states in America. And unfortunately, despite the great wealth of agriculture there, three of the five most impoverished areas of America are in the Central Valley of California. 21% of the kids have asthma. It's an area that's always been underinvested and left behind. One of the ideas of the people who came before me who promoted high-speed rail was to connect regions like that are underserved. And there's going to be tremendous benefits both for our communities and theirs to have those kind of connections that don't exist now. But right now, we're building about 130 miles of track from north of Bakersfield to north of Fresno, and the construction is underway.
Mm-hmm. So one of the questions I have on the Valley, certainly I've heard the arguments, it's really important to start there for the reasons that you mentioned. But I wonder if politically it makes it more challenging to get the buy-in when you're starting there. You mentioned how people in the Bay Area and L.A. don't know high-speed rail is under construction. And the cold fact of the matter is more voters live in the cities in L.A. and San Francisco. And you've also got more sort of conservative opposition to the project in the Central Valley. So politically, do you think that creates more problems for the system that we aren't starting it to link, say, between LA and Anaheim, where you have an initial system that would have good ridership and get that buy-in at least from Southern California?
I think everything you just said, Ethan, is exactly and precisely right. And it certainly has been a much more challenging political environment. In 2012, the legislature had to vote to release bond money and even to release the federal money to us. We got through the California State Senate by one vote. And so it was very controversial at the time. And a number of even urban Democrats said, why are we spending this money in the Valley? Now, one of the things that we've done is that we have substantially increased the simultaneous investments in what we call the bookends to really deal with that political issue, but also because we want to bring early benefits to as many people as possible. So we have taken high-speed rail bond money and committed it to the Caltrain electrification. And that is the number one transportation priority here in the Bay Area, is to get Caltrain between San Francisco and San Jose electrified. It will mean not only cleaner trains but faster trains, because electric trains accelerate and decelerate faster. It means that they can put more trains on the track. We will end up using that track and that electrification system, but there's no reason to wait till we get here for that. So we're working very closely in partnership with Caltrain to get that done now. And we're doing similar things in Southern California. So the point you raised is exactly correct. And our response to that was to accelerate the investments in these bookends of the system, even while we're building, to mix a metaphor, the spinal part in the Central Valley.
And now some critics, I think there's maybe even be a lawsuit on this, are saying that that's not an appropriate use of the bond funds to modernize or electrify Caltrain, Metrolink. What is your response to those charges?
Well, the response to those charges is that it is a proper use of the bond funds if those dollars are building what will ultimately be the high-speed rail system. And one of the big changes we made in 2012 was to move away from the idea that in the urbanized area between San Jose and San Francisco that we would build a separate standalone set of high-speed rail tracks. We were asked by people like Congresswoman Anna Eshoo and Assemblymember Rich Gordon to look at whether or not we could coexist on the Caltrain tracks. And the legislature determined that we told them that we thought we could. They actually put that into the law that to the greatest extent possible we're to be in that corridor. That saves us about $15 billion. It has no material impact on the speed of the train. The trains were not going to be going 200 miles an hour in that corridor anyway. They'd be going more like 120. And it has some impact on capacity, but that's probably years down the road before we hit that. So to save $15 billion, to not really lose anything in terms of speed, and to reduce the environmental impact of trying to build this into the urban corridor, we made that decision to blend our system with theirs. But therefore, it's a legal use of the money because we are essentially doing Caltrain electrification now, but creating the system that we will operate on.
So eventually, will it be seamless that the high-speed rail tracks are just going to – the high-speed rail trains are going to go right onto the Caltrain tracks, and it'll be a one-seat ride?
Yes, it will be seamless. It will be a one-seat ride. We will be putting in maybe up to 8 miles of passing tracks so that we can go past the slower local trains. But both we and Caltrain have determined that there are ways to make this work. And some people have said, well, this is not real high-speed rail. This is exactly what they do in Europe and other places. They share the tracks between local and intercity high-speed trains. In Germany, they actually share them with local high-speed trains and freight trains. So there's nothing radical about it. It's really the intelligent way to build it.
And the bond issue requires a 2-hour, 40-minute maximum time between LA and San Francisco. So using this blended approach, you know, once the trains are able to use the Metrolink and Caltrain tracks, are we still going to be able to meet that bond requirement?
Yes, and that was one of the things we had to convince ourselves of. And, you know, the proof of that is if you go back and you pull out the 2008 business plan of the High Speed Rail Authority. It's before I was there, before Governor Brown was there, before anybody ever thought about this blended system. They have a map in there that shows the estimated speeds of the train at various parts of the system. And between San Jose and San Francisco, it shows 120 miles an hour. So because of track geometry, you don't come screaming into these urban areas at these high speeds. And you do slow down there. But we are not only able to meet the 2-hour and 40-minute design time, but right now our engineers tell us that we're about 7 or 8 minutes to the good on mm-hmm. that.
And if you hadn't done this blended system, what would have been the process you would have had to take? Create a whole new alignment through there and expand the
right
of way?
That's right. And so think about how you would try to lay out an alignment between San Jose up through Palo Alto, Atherton, Redwood City, and so forth. You'd be taking an enormous amount of very high-value land, and that's why some of the legislative leaders said we need you to take a look at not doing that.
But there is a loss of speed without that additional alignment, correct?
Not materially. and again, the thing that determines the speed of high-speed rail trains is the radius of the curves. And so even if we were putting in our own tracks, to try to go through those built-up urban areas, if you really were going to have straight tracks, you'd be just taking out an enormous amount of built-up residences and businesses. And that's why in every place you go in the world, if you come into Paris, you know, the train is just slowing down as it's getting to the environs. And this is no different.
Now, let's say engineers miss something. If the train doesn't meet that 2-hour, 40-minute mark, and I mean, what are there any sort of penalties? I mean, what happens if we end up falling short at the end of the day?
Well, the law says that we have to be designed to achieve that in order to get the bonds. So what has happened and will probably continue to happen is opponents of the project will litigate, and we will show that, and just as we've demonstrated publicly, that our engineers show that we're able to do that. But here's the real issue. In order to operate without a subsidy, we have to attract riders. In order to attract riders, we have to make this a competitive service that is going to beat their experience on the airlines. So it's in our interest to make sure that this operates as efficiently as possible. The penalty for us would be a system that somehow was not economically performing, financially performing. And that's unacceptable to us. So we're being extremely careful to make sure that the things we're doing – I guess the best way to say it is, as one of my colleagues says, we're not building a high-speed rail system. We're building an enterprise. We're building something that has to operate with these other systems and has to provide a competitive opportunity for customers.
Mm-hmm. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Our guest tonight is Dan Richard, chair of the board of directors of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. So we invite you to call in with your questions or comments. What would you like to know about the current plans for California's high-speed rail? Are you concerned that the cost of the project will outweigh the benefits it provides? The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org on our Facebook page. You can post that. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @CityVisions at KALW. Well, let's go back to this discussion around the sort of present state of construction and what voters can expect next. So it's under construction now in the Valley. What's the next phase? When is it going to start coming into the big cities on the coast?
So our plan, as laid out in the business plan, which you can find on the website at the California High Speed Rail Authority, which is at, I think, hsr.ca.gov. Our plans basically are that after this initial construction, we want to get the first operating system going, and that is going to connect the Central Valley to Silicon Valley and San Francisco. So from north of Fresno at Madera, we would turn to the west and build across the valley, past Los Banos and the reservoir there, into Gilroy, and then come up to San Jose, and then roll onto the Caltrain tracks and alignment into San Francisco. We believe that we'll talk about this in a little bit, but the cap and trade program that the legislature has enacted to have a greenhouse gas emissions control generates income, and we get some of that for the high-speed rail program. There's some uncertainties around that program, but if they get resolved, we will have enough money with the bond money, the federal money, the cap and trade money to build the first operating system of high-speed rail to connect the Central Valley to the Bay Area by the year 2025. And that will mean that people from the Central Valley can come here. It will mean that you can leave here and be climbing up Half Dome, you know, a couple hours later.
Mm-hmm. So a question on that route. There was some controversy about the fact that it comes up through San Benito County into San Jose. There's concern around, you know, creating more sprawl in that area, and that some people argue it would have made more sense to come over the Altamont Pass following existing commuter patterns, maybe going across the bridge with a spur down to San Jose. What's your response to critics of that route alignment?
Well, that was a pretty hot issue several years ago, and a lot of that was laid out before I got to the High Speed Rail Authority, although we had to defend it. The problem was, going back to your statement about the 2 hours and 40 minutes, you know, San Jose is and the Silicon Valley are enormously important for California economically and culturally and so forth. And that alignment basically put San Jose on a spur and meant that if you were going to serve San Jose, either they weren't going to get enough service or you'd have to go down there and then turn around and go back to San Francisco, which would blow the time requirement. So the decision was made that all the trains should come up through San Jose. Also, that other Altamont Pass route is not either as easy or as environmentally preferable as some people would like you to believe. So, but those issues were fought out and the alignment was laid out a while ago, and that's pretty much a settled issue now.
So let's go back to your comment about cap and trade. This is an important part of the funding where we have this cap and trade program, as you mentioned, to control greenhouse gas emissions, and some of the allowances that polluters get to be able to continue carbon polluting are auctioned, which then creates a proceeds that the state has dedicated at 25% to high-speed rail. But, you know, putting on my environmental lawyer hat, there is legal uncertainty. There's a court case that's challenging the use of those the auction as a method of distributing the allowances. If a court could potentially rule that all the proceeds collected to date essentially has been invalid in terms of the fact that it might have been a tax, which would have required a two-thirds vote. It's a little complicated in the legislature, but that would have been the legal hurdle. So
Right. How
do you deal with the uncertainty, first, that, you know, some of the money that's already been spent may have not been collected legally, as a court may rule, or that going forward after 2020, it may be ruled invalid without a two-thirds vote of the legislature?
Well, in terms of what's been done so far, as you noted, Ethan, that is the subject of some challenge, and I get that. But let me just say that, if the cap and trade program goes away, then obviously that's a hole in our funding, and we will then have to look for alternative sources, and that won't be easy, and so it would clearly have an impact on the program. So we're all adults here. I'm not going to try to pretend otherwise. But I will say that I think that the cap and trade program will succeed and it will be sustained for this reason. Even if for some reason those court challenges were to succeed, I believe that the cap and trade program will be reauthorized by the legislature, and there's a very simple reason why. In this last session, the legislature passed and Governor Brown signed Senate Bill 32, which extends California's greenhouse gas emissions controls at least out to 2030. Now, I remember when the first greenhouse gas law was passed, it was industry that wanted cap and trade. Because if you're going out and telling all these people, I'm going to cinch down on your levels of carbon emissions, and the only tool that I have is command and control, and I'm going to order smokestack by smokestack these reductions, that's a very big impact on industry. They wanted to have the ability to have cap and trade to give them additional tools to comply. So even though the cap and trade program hasn't yet been extended, the underlying statute has been extended, and I think that what we're going to see is in this legislative session, I would hope, or the governor has indicated, you know, one way or another, he's going to make sure that this program goes forward. So we'll deal with the, you know, if the trapdoor opens, we'll deal with that. But right now, I believe that California has committed itself to a future that is decarbonizing. Cap and trade, I think, is a critical tool to make that happen. And, you know, as we talk about this a little further, I want to get into some of the other environmental benefits of high-speed rail and why we think this is an appropriate use of cap and trade.
Yeah, well, then let's get to that. But in the meantime, we have a caller, Robert from Palo Alto. Robert, welcome to City Visions.
Good evening, folks. I've been listening to your program for quite a while, and I haven't heard too many critical questions addressed to our guest. It's been mostly you lobbying for the easy questions to him and him speaking unrebutted. I'm a little bit disturbed with that format. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what is, Mr. Richard, what is the current amount of money that you've raised here apropos of the stricture in the barely passing referendum of 2008, which said that you're not supposed to spend it in money until all the money has been committed and raised, which I don't think you've been successful in doing.
Well, first of all, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with your description of what the law said. It does not say that all the money has to be raised before we can spend any money. The law was very clear in 2008 that high-speed...
You mean the referendum?
Yeah, it's a statutory initiative, and it basically said that we... you know, it's a very complex law, but one of the things it says is you can build this in segments and that you can use the bond money for any usable segment. And they define a usable segment as basically having two stations in it and having these other attributes. I don't think that anybody would have reasonably expected, if they were a voter in 2008, that they were going to open up a 520-mile or ultimately 800-mile high-speed rail system like you unwrap a train set, a model train set on Christmas morning, you know, all together and ready to go. These systems are always built in stages, and the Bond Act allows us to build it in stages. So the key for us is to have enough money to build any usable segment. We have the money right now to build essentially the test segment in the Central Valley. And with cap and trade, as well as the federal and the bond money, we have enough to open an operating system. Now, we can get into this, but one of the key things here is because high-speed rail systems generate positive cash flows, our plan is that once we get the initial system built, we will be auctioning the rights to operate that to the private sector. They will write us a check that will help us start to build other legs of the system. I will hasten to add that I think that the federal government ultimately will have to add additional dollars to this. And, you know, right now, if we didn't get any more federal money, they'd be paying for 5% of California's high-speed rail system. The federal government routinely puts in 50 to 80% of transportation systems. It's really kind of outrageous. I think ultimately, and frankly, both candidates have talked about infrastructure spending in the next administration. Most economists are saying that we need to have some kind of fiscal stimulus, and so I think there's going to be some more money, federal money for infrastructure. But we will have enough money to get an operating leg up and running.
Yeah, I saw even Donald Trump came out as a bit of a fan of high-speed rail, so it could be a win-win, I suppose, for high-speed rail backers either way. I want to thank Robert for that phone call, and if you feel like we need more hard-hitting questions for Dan Richard, this is your chance. This is a live call-in show. We encourage you to call in with those questions. So this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is Dan Richard, Chair of the Board of Directors of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. We'd love for you to call in and join the conversation. Number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisions_KALW. Well, I wanted to talk a bit about the costs because they were initially supposed to be maybe in the neighborhood of around $33 billion. When it came to the voters, it ballooned way up past $100 billion, and now it's been brought down. Can you explain what's been behind these fluctuating cost figures?
I think the first thing, first of all, it's a little hard to go back and reconstruct what was the initial cost that was promised to people, because it referred to $2,006 dollars, and you know there's inflation and all that. But let's use the number $43 billion, which was some people have pointed to that was in the Bond Act. You know, this is the thing. The cost has gone up, and it hasn't gone up because construction is out of control or anything like that. It's gone up because when you come in and sit down to actually look at what it takes to build this, people can make all the estimates that they want. But, you know, just this week I was sitting down with representatives of a food processing company in the Central Valley that is begging us to do some things about the alignment that don't impact their food processing operation. We will, and it will cost some money. There are people who want certain legs undergrounded. There are people who want historic areas preserved. As you really start to get down to the nub of designing these things, you're making alignment decisions all the time, and you're trying to preserve things that are important for our society. So to some degrees, the external costs have now been internalized into this as we really see what it takes to build it on the ground. Having said that, I think the costs have stabilized, and one of the things, that when that $100 million number was what we said when we looked at it would be the fully inflated cost over 30 years, which is different from the way that most people estimate these things, if we built an entirely 100% standalone high-speed rail system. I mentioned before we saved $15 billion by using the Caltrain tracks. We were able to bring it down some more by doing something similar in the south. The current estimate is about $64 billion fully inflated over the next 15, 20 years to build it. If it were today's dollars, it'd be closer to $54, $56 billion. And that sounds like a lot of money, because it is a lot of money. But here's the thing that people forget. You can't compare that against doing nothing. We have 38 million people in the state. We're going to have 50 million people in the state by either 2050 or 2060. It doesn't matter. It's the equivalent of the state of Ohio picking up and coming to California. Those people will need mobility. Our children, the new Californians, they will need mobility. The alternative cost of providing an equivalent level of mobility has been estimated at somewhere between $120 and $180 billion. So you have to look at, is this the right investment? And I'm happy to have that debate with people about whether this is the right investment. But I refuse to accept the premise that there can be no investment.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Matt from Millbrae. Matt, welcome to City Visions. You're on the air.
Thank you, gentlemen. Great radio. Very enjoyable. Mr. Richards, I was concerned because one of the rationales you provided for building the first segments of track in the Central Valley was that it's cheaper to build there, and that if we were to start building on the terminal ends, well, the cost is so high that we wouldn't get much track built at all. And I acknowledge that, and I also acknowledge that this is classic complex trade-offs and really interesting decisions on how you're going to frame this. But here's my point. I'm concerned that it is true, I acknowledge, that the urban area tract building is extremely expensive. However, if we postpone that to 8 years from now, what annual rate of inflation of cost on those urban lines are you factoring into your calculations? Because my informed judgment is that by the time we actually get around to building those very expensive urban caps on either end, the cost is going to be completely out of control, and so that we're approaching it in a cost ineffective manner rather than a prudent use of our resources.
Matt, I understand the question, and it's a good one, and this is something that we've thought about. So let me try to allay your concerns in a couple of ways. First of all, to answer your direct question, our cost estimates, that $64 billion fully inflated, is based on a 3% inflation average over the lifetime. Now, we haven't seen 3%, and so, you know, our costs at this point, you know, are probably a little more conservative than the inflation rate has been. But secondly, we go back to this issue of making simultaneous investments in the bookends. So we have just reached an agreement with Caltrain to provide $700 million, roughly half of the electrification project. Now, what that means is that when we ultimately are going to run high-speed rail between San Jose and San Francisco, a lot of the basic work will have been done simultaneous with what we're doing in the Central Valley for precisely the reason that you mentioned, and also another reason, which is those benefits of Caltrain electrification are going to be immediate and near-term and going to have a tremendous impact on the ridership here. So we're not simply holding off on the more expensive pieces till the end and suffering those inflation effects. But it also, the ultimate import of your question is this. This would be the time right now for the federal government and others to be pouring money into infrastructure, not just high-speed rail, because the inflation costs are so low. This is the time that we should be selling bonds because the inflation costs are so low. Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't wait. And I don't think we're really waiting in the detrimental way that you're worried about, Matt.
And I'm sure we'll be hearing that argument next year, whoever the president is, that we need more infrastructure spending in the country in general. Let's go back to the phone lines. First of all, thank you, Matt, for that question. But let's go to Mark now. Mark, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you. Besides inflation costs, interest rates are at an all-time low, too. Mm-hmm. So now...
Right.
Couldn't be more opportune. I don't know why people are complaining about the cost. I mean, California is probably really the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world, and we can't get around compared to the Northeast or Europe or Asia. I mean, it's long overdue, and the cost will long be forgotten after this is up and going. But my question is, why is it taking so long? I think the Transcontinental Railroad was built faster.
Certainly, the Golden Gate Bridge, 2.5 years to build. This is a question that I've certainly been wondering, too. What's the source of the delay? It's already been 8 years since the bond measure passed.
Well, you know who asks me this question all the time is Governor Jerry Brown, who would like to make sure that he's here to ride on this. It's very frustrating because there are a lot of things that I think we'd like to see move faster. I think ultimately, and I want to make sure I'm careful how I say this, but ultimately, you know, since the Transcontinental Railroad, and if we look at our friends in China, we don't just plow across areas. I mean, we do extensive environmental work and design work. And frankly, the environmental process itself takes 2 years. You know, some of the other countries who come to visit us are kind of shocked because they build whole systems in the time it takes us to analyze and design. But it's just we live in a very complex society. There are a lot of interests that have to be respected in the physical environment, cultural impacts, and so forth. And we just have to be careful that we know what we do or are doing before we start building.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is Dan Richard, chair of the California High Speed Rail Authority, and we'd love for you to join us. The number to call to join this conversation, if you have any questions, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisionskalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using at cityvisionskalw. So, Dan, you mentioned the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA. It's our bedrock environmental law. But certainly a lot of people proposing big infrastructure projects like high-speed rail get frustrated at the amount of time it takes and how it can open the project up to litigation. I'm curious from your perspective how you've seen the effect of CEQA on high-speed rail. Has it changed the route? Has it changed the numbers? Has it brought about any benefits in terms of doing some advanced study of the route before, you know, getting in there in the dirt?
It certainly has taken time. It certainly has changed the route. That's the purpose of CEQA, is to look at alternatives. And so we pick alternatives that, you know, to the greatest extent possible, have the minimal environmental impacts.
And can you give an example of a route change that resulted because of CEQA?
Yeah. In the area south of Fresno, there was one route that we were looking at that basically it was decided because of the CEQA process that it was going to impact both vernal pools and a wetlands area there, and we ended up taking a different route. But, you know, CEQA has been – the CEQA process is one that forces you to consider all the impacts. And the thing that's really important to understand is it's not just physical impacts on biota and species, but cultural impacts, environmental justice impacts, all those things are important considerations.
And let's go back to the phone lines to RJ. RJ, welcome to City Visions.
Thanks for the program. My question is kind of two parts. Will you be planning the cost of a round trip from San Francisco to L.A.? Based on the cost of the competitive airline ride, and then also this could be a real boon to the workforce that's in the Central Valley trying to commute to the city, and would the cost from the Central Valley to the city or to Silicon Valley be affordable for the average worker?
Mm-hmm.
I'll
so RJ,
take my answers off the air.
So thank you, RJ. Two great questions there.
They're great questions. So first of all, RJ, the our estimates right now, just for planning purposes, were to do exactly what you said, to plan that our ridership and the revenue that's produced from it needs to be based on competition with airlines. So what we said was for analytical purposes, we would estimate that that the cost from San Francisco to L.A. would be 85% of a discounted airfare ticket. So even though Southwest has gotten pretty expensive, but you can still get a $100 Southwest ticket. So if we had the system up and running today, our estimate is it would cost you about $83 or $85 to get to L.A. The real issue is that we're going to be bringing in an operator to operate the system, and that operator is going to look at the pricing based on what it takes for them to make money. And so on your question about workforce coming in, you know, using it as a commute mechanism, which does happen in Japan and other places, you know, that pricing is going to have to be determined by folks at that point. But in talking with Silicon Valley businesses, they already provide some very progressive support for workers in terms of transportation costs, defraying transportation costs. And we would expect that some of that will happen in the future.
Now, are you concerned that this might lead to sprawl in the Central Valley? I should disclose that we've done a report on this at Berkeley Law, a joint project with UCLA Law, too, called the High Speed Foundation. But this is one of the big issues, that if you're going to allow people now to access the markets in San Francisco and L.A., maybe on a daily basis, or maybe it's a remote, you know, department of a company based in L.A. or San Francisco, how are we going to rein in that sprawl, especially in a place like the Valley where it's flat, there's no real, you know, geographical barrier to sprawl?
So, Ethan, I was looking at the clock because I thought, you know, if Ethan doesn't raise this question by 7:45, I want to bring it up because I think it's the most important thing that we're looking at here. It may sound a little funny for me to say this as the chair of the High Speed Rail Authority, but I give speeches all the time where I say that the thing that worries me the most, it's not the funding. The funding will ultimately be there. It's not our ability to build it. Californians can build this. We've built amazing things in this state. What worries me is making sure that we're doing the right thing. And I like to say that high-speed rail is a tool. It's a technology. Technology is a tool. A hammer can build a house. A hammer can commit mayhem. If we don't do this right, we could be leading to sprawl in the Central Valley. And that's why I've just taken charge of a transit land use committee to work with the cities around the stations that we have in the Central Valley to really make sure that we're promoting the right land use practices with density and connectivity in those areas. The Central Valley has been subject to enormous sprawl already. Estimates made by leading agricultural experts is that 10% of the 6.6 million acres of farmland there could fall prey to development over the next 30 or 40 years. We see high-speed rail as a way to revitalize some of those cities that are hollowed out where there's nothing but sprawl now, and to create urban cores. We won't end all sprawl, but we can do things with high-speed rail as a tool that can be very good from a land use standpoint. We're focused on that now. It's a passion of mine to make sure that we get the land use right here and the right policies in place so that we don't just become a tool for sprawl.
Mm-hmm. And we may need some mix of urban growth boundaries, things like that, to try to rein that in the valley in particular.
I agree.
Want to go back to the phone lines. Ian from Oakland, you're on City Visions. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate this program, and I am also all for the commuter rail, or rather more transit, mass transit. But forgive me, from a layman's terms, I'm just kind of curious, is there projections for, this is silly, but self-driving vehicles, would that have an impact? And actually, I'm really concerned about parking. So if you want to take the high-speed rail, would there be adequate parking? Would the cost of the parking be? I think that's a detriment away from taking some mass transit.
Well, I'm going to come at this from a little different perspective because I'm about to stick my neck out and suggest that we develop policies that are much, much, much less parking dependent for access to our stations than has been the case in the past. I mean, if we step back and look at this, infrastructure projects like this last 100 years. We're not just building this for the 21st century, but the 22nd century. And I do believe that autonomous vehicles are going to come about. I think it's going to be a boon to especially people as they get older, but, you know, throughout society. But I don't want to be locked in to building massive parking structures when, in fact, I think in the future people will be able, between ride-sharing services, the gig economy, self-driving cars, we need to be thinking ahead, you know, where these technologies are taking us. And, you know, when I was on BART, we built a 3,000-car parking garage at the Millbrae station. That's nice. It is not the best use of land around a transit station. So I'm speaking only for myself right now because my colleagues on the board have not yet adopted this policy. But we're going to be aggressive in getting out there. We have a public process. I encourage everybody to get involved in that. We need all the best thinking on this. But there need to be better ways to get to a high-speed rail station with bus rapid transit, with autonomous vehicles, with connectivity to other systems. And that's what we need to focus on and not just building a bunch of 20th century parking garages.
Well, on the subject of technology changes, Zach from San Francisco asks about the Hyperloop. And I'm sure you get this question all the time. What's your response to people who say, and for those of you who are not familiar, this is Elon Musk's proposed pneumatic tube that can shoot people like, you know, mail gets shot through a slot in a lot of buildings at high rates of speed. And he says this would be a lot cheaper than high-speed rail and, you know, potentially easier to build. We don't know. Certainly maybe faster if the theory all gets played out out in reality. So how do you respond to the Hyperloop question?
Well, first of all, one of the things that you didn't get to in my biography was my first job out of college was that I spent 5 years at NASA. I'm a big technology guy. I love the innovation that people like Elon Musk bring. He's a California success story. I think Hyperloop is a fascinating technology. We've talked with the folks there, urged them to build prototypes. I don't think that it will be, you know, as cheap as people say, and other people have said that. But that's not to say that that technology should not be looked at. The one thing that I would come back to, though, is that if you go back to the original purpose of high-speed rail, with all our connectivity to the other rail systems, we're building a network. And in a network, you know, there may be some role for point-to-point technologies, but I think that the network nature of high-speed rail is going to be very important. So I look at Hyperloop and I look at Maglev, and I think these are technologies that need to be explored. But, you know, right now, countries around the world are on their fourth and fifth generation of high-speed rail-type trains, and I do think this technology is going to be a cutting-edge technology for decades to come.
And let's go back to the phone lines. Doris, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I may be in the 19th century in my thinking, but as far as I'm concerned, first of all, has there been a huge clamoring for high-speed rail? I don't really see that happening. And secondly, from my perspective, a wonderful train that would get us to L.A. from San Francisco in under 5 hours would in itself be a boon. I don't think we need super fancy, super fast necessarily. Why don't we just improve the system we have and make it streamlined in terms of not having to stop, pay a huge amount of money between stations and, you know, in other words, have a nonstop option and have a more, so I say, local option so you could stop more often if you choose to. So if we get to L.A. under 5 hours, to me, that would be a big boon. And the other final thing I'd like to say is getting people to and from, I've had this idea for the ferries as well. How about shuttles? What's wrong with shuttles? We don't need self-driving fancy cars for rich people. Shuttles can suit, you know, it could be part of your ticket. You pay a little surcharge to get the shuttle to come to whichever stop you want it to come to, whether it's your house or somewhere more public, and have a schedule that connects with the train logically, both to it and from it. I think that makes more sense than anything.
Mm-hmm. So let me address both those questions. First of all, on your second one, I think absolutely, you know, there's going to be a basket of great options as technologies develop, and shuttles are an important part of people getting to the airport and to ferries and to train stations today. So we want to be able to build our stations to accommodate shuttles, bus rapid transit, and so forth. So on your very provocative question about why do we need high speed, why not just a train line? First of all, I think the best way I can answer it is this way. Most people don't realize this, but the air corridor between San Francisco and Los Angeles is the first or second busiest in the United States, but it's also the most delayed. 40% of the flights are delayed between San Francisco and LA. And one of the biggest proponents of the high-speed rail train system is the San Francisco International Airport and their counterparts in Los Angeles. They want to use the airport as we move through this century for long-distance flights, not short-haul flights. And if we look at the European system, you really can't get an airliner from Paris to Brussels anymore. All that's done by train. And so a modern transportation system is best designed to use our airline resources for those kind of long-haul systems. And I think, with all due respect, for a lot of people, a five-hour train trip is not going to have the same attractiveness as a two-and-a-half-hour train trip in terms of being able to divert passengers from the air transportation system. You know, we saw this in the East where the Acela corridor between Boston and New York and Washington has now got something like 78% of the traffic. And going back to 1980, it was in like the 20 or 30%. We've seen this around the world, that there's this shift from airlines to trains for these markets that are 500-600 miles. And I think that there is a very strong market for that, and it's a more effective and better use of our airport resources.
So I want to go back to the issue of funding, and we talked about, you know, how cap and trade funds are providing a revenue stream. And when that was passed in the legislature, you heard all this. Well, this is a steady revenue stream now. We can finally get that private funding that we need to really get the system fully funded and operated. But yet we haven't seen anything actually materialize there. Can you give us any updates on what the prospects are for actually getting private investors now that we've got the system under construction and maybe some sense of where the revenue is coming from?
We have strong interest from the private sector. I know people, you know, raise this question all the time. The private sector is there, and they are ready to invest in this. The key issue for us is because we're not allowed to offer a subsidy, that means the private sector putting their money in goes at risk immediately. And one of the things that I've said, even to some of our very conservative opponents, is I said, if you think about it, we don't want the private sector to have the first dollars in. We want them to bid for the rights to operate on our system. If there's too much risk at first, those bids will be discounted. They'll be much lower. The intelligent thing to do is, frankly, what we're doing, which also is what was done in Japan and other places, to have the government put up the money for the first operating system, reduce the risk, demonstrate that there is ridership. This is, after all, new in America. So many of these companies or even countries that are looking at this still want to see the ridership. Once that's done, then you're going to see a torrent of private sector money that's going to come in, and it's going to come in at the right time and with the right benefit to us because they won't discount their bids based on that risk.
And in the meantime, we've got a big challenge just connecting the system to Southern California, getting over the Tehachapis. And my understanding that there was a lot of political influence in terms of the route going over the Tehachapis, that it's serving Palmdale, not necessarily because that makes the most sense logically. It creates a little more time on the system, but that there was a lot of political support for that. Can you describe kind of what the prospects are for getting the system eventually over the Tehachapis and maybe how much politics has influenced the route selection there?
It really hasn't been politics so much because actually the Bond Act laid out and said you're going to connect Los Angeles, Palmdale, Bakersfield, Fresno. The Bond Act was very specific because they wanted to make sure that these communities were connected. Now, were there politics in that? Well, you know, probably. But in fact, it goes back to this notion of connecting a lot of underserved areas. And from Palmdale, so we will get across the Tehachapis. People have asked that question, gee, isn't this a terrible technological challenge? I'm always amazed when people kind of talk down Californians' ability to build these things. As one of my colleagues says at the High Speed Rail Authority, you know, Union Pacific crossed the Tehachapis with picks and shovels in the you know, 1880s. We ought to be able to do it now. From Palmdale, the interesting thing is that tunneling technology has really advanced. And we're now looking at a straight shot tunnel from Palmdale, 22 miles right down to Burbank. That actually avoids a lot of environmental and environmental justice issues.
And do you think the system actually will be open LA to San Francisco by 2029? Are we on pace for that?
You know, our plan is 2029. I think that we can get there. I think we'll need some help from our friends in the federal government so we can do some things simultaneously. But I will say this. I learned this on BART. Once it's built, people will be wondering why the heck we never did it in the first place.
Well, on that note, that's City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight was Dan Richard, chair of the board of directors of the High Speed Rail Authority. Thank you, Dan, so much for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. We'll be off next Monday for Halloween, but join my co-host Joseph Pache in 2 weeks for our pre-election special. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.